My name's Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
By God's grace, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April 11th, 1977. And for that, I am eternally grateful. And before I go any further about my home group or anything, I don't know if we said the Serenity Prayer to open up this meeting. If we did, I missed it. So, because that's usually when I kind of take a breath and when we say the Serenity Prayer before I start. So if you don't mind, let's just join in and say the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I want to start off by saying I gave you my name and my sobriety date. I got sober in Texas, and I always give my sobriety date. And in Texas, I don't care if you're at a discussion meeting, a step study, a big book study. When you're called on to speak, you always give your name and your sobriety date. And it said, if you don't give your sobriety date, it's probably because you don't have one. So I'm always give my sobriety date. And I'm here to tell you that is the most important day of my life, because that's when my life began. I love this. Celebrate the miracle. And that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to be telling you about the miracles that have happened to me as a result of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a home group. That's the West Kennett group in Jacksonville, Florida. We meet on Monday nights at 8 o'clock. And I used to say, Dave and I are in the phone book. You know, now that we're sober, we can be in the phone book. But we're not. We don't have a home phone anymore. We just have we just have cell phones. We finally got rid of that, so I can't say that anymore. But at any rate, please, call me. I have a friend in here who has called me when she came to Jacksonville. And the time she was in Jacksonville was when my husband was going through all the stuff, and I'll let you all know about that. But I didn't get to meet her, so I met her tonight. So it's just that's how God works. I mean, we're such a small Alcoholics Anonymous when it comes down to. There's a lot of us sober, thank God. There's a lot of us sober. But also, it just seems like we just gather up together. And I don't know about you, but I can go anywhere, and it just seems like I can spot my people. I don't know. It's just amazing. I can just spot my people. I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor. And I am an active member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, at 39 years of sobriety, I am busier in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous than I have ever been. I sponsor more people than I have ever sponsored, and I'm into more service than I've ever been into. And I have a really, really good reason for that. And that is, I love my life. I absolutely love the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And I truly believe what Bill has said and what Ken has said, and I'm going to compliment them further in just a second, about we just get a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. That's all we get, is a daily reprieve. And one of the things that I am clear on, and I've been around long enough to watch this happen, is that this disease is a progressive illness. The book tells me, but I've gotten to watch it. And I'm here to tell you, if I take a drink of alcohol, I'm not going to start off 39 years ago. I'm going to probably be the guy in the big book he was dead within a year, but I'd probably be dead before that, because this disease is working on me. And I'm really clear that today, at 39 years of sobriety, I am more alcoholic than I was 39 years ago. So I don't need less meetings. I need more meetings. I want to be 52 years sober. I may not live that long. You obviously got sober very young. But that's what I want. I want to take my last breath sober. So today I know that I'm more alcoholic than I was 39 years ago. So I don't need less meetings. I need more meetings. I don't need less sponsees. I need more sponsees. And I certainly don't need less service. I need more service. Because I'm in bigger danger today than I was 39 years ago. And I don't ever forget that. I don't ever forget that. I'm still get up. When my eyes pop up open in the morning, it's, oh dear God, please keep me sober today. And give me the willingness to serve you and to have a servant's heart. My sponsor, Dottie Harris, used to line us up and say, you will always enjoy sobriety if you pray for a servant's heart. And I have enjoyed. Has sobriety been easy? Not exactly. Life's in session. It doesn't matter if you're sober. Life's in session. So life has been in session for 39 years. Bill, thank you for inviting me last year and again this year. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I have friends here, and I am so excited to be with them. Kent, you rocked. You absolutely rocked. I've heard you a lot, too. And this year, I haven't gotten to be with you. We had a lot of stuff scheduled together this year, and I haven't got to play with you in Alcoholics Anonymous till today, till we got here last night. But you rocked, baby. And my friends, Bill and Marlene, good Lord. I'm trying to think. I think I don't know if you remember how sober you were when we went to Denver. But it's been a long time ago. 25. When was it?
It was about
31 years ago. God, I didn't know I was going to live this long. Wow. Yeah, it's been a long time ago. And we've been together. I know that we were at that Fingers Lake place in New York when I was 10 years sober because they gave me a birthday cake. And you were at that, too. So, wow, we've been together. We've been doing this journey a long, long time. And I just love you both so much. I'm going to apologize for not hearing the Al-Anon speaker and the young people speaker. But I have my husband with me this weekend. He's not here tonight, but I have my husband with me. And I'll talk a little bit about him and a little bit. And it's also celebrating the miracle. Celebrating the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous that we're here. Being able to be sober. Oh, there's been so much good talk about God. I'm telling you, Bill, I didn't get to hear you, Kent, because I went over and got Dave. But you rocked my world this morning and with your talk this morning. And you too, I mean, it's just been a long time since I've been in a conference, and I'm used to being in a conference almost every weekend. And this is the first, you know, I haven't been in a conference in a long time. So it's just been absolutely fabulous to hear both of you. And the talk about God. Because, you know, people say, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they used to talk about the spiritual side of Alcoholics Anonymous. There isn't any other side. That's all this is. And I heard, you know, if God runs you out of here, whiskey will run you back in. You know, that's just all there is to it. That somewhere, and there's all kinds. I know that there are a lot of people that have a hard time with the word God. I'm grateful I didn't. I didn't have a hard time. I did not know the God then when I came in that I know today. Now, I've lived in Southern California 27 years. I've been out of the South for a long, long time. I married a military man, and I left the South. And then I came back, and I ended up getting sober in Texas. And I fell in love with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we left Texas married, but not to each other. And so there's all my story's not all that great. I wasn't a prime example of Alcoholics Anonymous in those early days. But the deal is that I left the South. Now, when I started speaking in AA, unless I was in the South, I would talk about being raised Southern Baptist. Now, some people don't know what that's like. They didn't know. I'm not sure it's like that anymore, but I'll tell you one thing. When I heard those preachers standing at that podium, slamming that podium and screaming at us and their veins sticking out and their faces were red and they were screaming into the congregation, "You're born a sinner. You're going to burn in hell. If you thought it, you've done it." I'm telling you, that was not exciting to me. That was very, very scary. So I came to AA with a very, very scary God. And I knew that there was no hope for me that I was going to burn in hell. You could not do what I did and be able to be saved. I didn't know anything about the God that I have today, the God of my understanding, who's forgiving. And I loved what you said. It was either you or Kent, I can't remember, that was talking about God's forgiving you while you're doing it. That was a beautiful line. Beautiful. We're already forgiven. We're already forgiven. Now, does that mean we're going to have an easy life? I read a non-approved AA book many, many years ago called The Road Less Traveled. The very first line says, life is difficult. Once that is understood, it's not too difficult. Now, I don't know about you, but I have come to believe that life is a spiritual classroom. And I'm here to learn whatever it is I need to learn in this lifetime. And my AA sponsor, Dottie, used to say, repeat for correction. And you know what? I got tired of repeating it for correction. Repeat it for correction. And I know today that life is a spiritual classroom. And I'm here to learn whatever. I'm going to learn something for every experience I've had. And you know, I've reached an age where I understand that better than I have ever understood it. That's what's happening. That I am in a spiritual classroom. I was just telling Ken, I'm going to share with you a very angry moment with God that I had. A very angry moment that has become one of the greatest gifts I've ever known. And most everything that I have experienced in this lifetime, no matter how tragic it seemed at the time, has turned out to be something that I have learned and grown from. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm living, breathing proof that you can become a real alcoholic as described in the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not come from alcoholic parents. I do not come from the disease of alcoholism. Now, I have a theory. My dad was a very rageful man, and he wasn't always rageful, but he had just a hair trigger temper. And you never knew when that was going to happen. As I look at it today, my dad was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I believe with all my heart, I never will be able to prove that if my dad would have taken a drink of whiskey, he'd have been an alcoholic. But we were told, thou shalt not drink, and we, by God, didn't. Did not drink. And the only person in my family that's an alcoholic, not an alcoholic, that drank, the only person that even drank, was my grandfather, my mother's father. father. And I can guarantee he never drank like me. So I don't know of any alcoholism. So I'm going to tell you right now that I am an alcoholic who never even knew another alcoholic till I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never knew an alcoholic. I never even, to this day, I didn't know an alcoholic. And I am an alcoholic, and I'm a real alcoholic. So all of that stuff, I'm a loved, cherished child. I'm an only child. My parents adored me. They sacrificed for me. My dad had a ninth grade education. My mother was a nurse. He was a contractor. He worked on houses. But they sacrificed and they gave me dancing lessons and gymnastic lessons, sent me to New York to study dancing. They sacrificed for me. My mother would sit up all night making dancing costumes. I was cherished, and I never knew it. Because you see, there was something wrong with me. I don't know what was ever inside of me, but my parents were showing me every way, telling me. I hear people all the time in AA and say, my mom or my dad never told me that they loved me. My parents told me all the time, that they loved me. And I never really felt it until I came to these rooms and had a spiritual awakening. Whatever was wrong with me was just something was wrong with me. I look back. I don't know if any of you do this yourself. And you go look at a picture when you were young. I used to think I was the ugliest person on earth. I hated myself. There was something wrong with me. Here I was given all this love. I was given many opportunities. And I never took them because something inside of me was so dead. I don't know what that was. I don't know if it's predisposition to alcoholism. I don't know. I haven't analyzed that. All I know is I'm a person who took a drink of alcohol and something happened to me that did not happen to other people. I know that I suffer today from a spiritual malady. I know what's wrong with me. I am so grateful I know what's wrong with me. It's not child abuse. You're going to hear my story. I am a child abuser, but I was not abused. But I was suffering from a spiritual malady. And I was suffering from it as long as my recollection will go back. You cannot feel like I felt as a child and have the life I had as a child. It doesn't add up. Doesn't add up. When I went to treatment for the first time, I've been a time or two, and when I went to treatment for the first time, we sat in groups and everybody talked about. I hear they do the same thing today they did when I went to treatment 39 years ago. You sit in group and everybody talks about, you know, what happened to them as little boys and girls. And I sat there and I thought, well, I can understand why you're an alcoholic, but why am I an alcoholic? None of those things happened to me. I know today it has nothing to do with anything. What it has to do with is that I am suffering from a spiritual malady. And whiskey solved that problem. It made me feel. It changed the way I felt and altered my perception. The best, one of the very best talks I've ever heard from Clancy. And I love Clancy. I think he describes the feelings of an alcoholic. I love the way he describes that. But he talks about us having a disease of perception. I don't perceive reality. My perception of reality is distorted, and it has been distorted since I was a child. I just don't see things the way they really are. I'm telling you today, I need a sponsor as bad as I've ever needed a sponsor. I can tell you exactly what's wrong with you. I got it. I got it down pat. I can tell you what's wrong with you, and when I sponsor people, I have no trouble doing that. It comes very easy for me. But I can tell you, I don't have a clue most of the time what's wrong with me. I cannot see my own reality. I need a sponsor. I still need a sponsor. I'm not done learning. I learned from Bill and Kent last night. I learn every day. And you may have said what you said last night every time I've heard you talk, but I didn't hear it that way. I didn't hear it that way. I know that I have a disease of perception. I'm suffering from a spiritual malady that only a spiritual solution will solve, and it only happens a day at a time. A day at a time. I just get a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance, which tells me I need to do something, of my spiritual condition. When I was 18 years old, I married an Air Force officer. Man, I thought I'd found my knight in shining armor. I'll tell you today, every time I go into an airport, you're going to hear some pushback from me if there's a military guy and he doesn't get on the plane first. A guy in uniform just still does it for me. And I loved the patriotism. I loved it all. I loved being a military wife. I never appreciated it or realized what a fabulous opportunity I had till long past it was over that I realized that, I had had such a beautiful gift. And I was the ripe old age of 18, and I married this Air Force officer, and I had no clue what I had signed up for. Absolutely no clue. And he was a bomber pilot, and we ended up going to our first duty station. And he went through training. We were only right out the gate. We went to Mather Air Force Base, and he went to B-47 training. And shortly, we'd been there. We'd been married maybe 2 weeks, and I got this invitation in the mail, and it had a big red mandatory stamped on it, and it was from the base commander's wife. And I was to attend a coffee that was given by the base commander's wife. And I want you to know that I am a person who could never stand up in school and give a book report or anything like that. I was terrified. I was way too embarrassed. And I still have the problem. I never say a lot of words I don't ever say quite right. I'll get them close enough that you know what I'm talking about. But most of the time I kind of make you laugh because I don't, I just tweak them just a little wrong. And I was always embarrassed because it seemed like I always got kind of tongue-tied with that. And I just never liked any kind, you know, I just was intimidated all the time, just totally intimidated. Well, I get this invitation, and I have, you know, I just know that these women are educated and sophisticated, and I'm just overwhelmed with feelings of inadequacy. And I've never gone to college. I have a high school education, and that's it. Now, I've always wanted those letters after my name, but I've just never wanted to go to school, so I don't have it. And I believe you can do and be anything you want to do and be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just, you know, I've always wanted the letters, just never wanted the work. You know, kind of want the title, but don't want to do the work. And so I just knew they were educated and sophisticated, and I'm just this little teenager. And we went to that luncheon, and this base commander's wife began to tell us, all of us little second lieutenant's wives that were sitting out there, what we were going to do to enhance our husband's career, and how we would attend the right dinner parties, how we would, you know, be attired correctly, would wear the right length gloves, all the things that we were going to do. And I'm telling you, I'm a hick from Texas. And I'm just like, oh, my God, what have I signed up for? And she said we would attend all functions. That would be our responsibility as an officer's wife. About 2 weeks later, there's an officer's wife luncheon, and I'm to attend that luncheon. Now, I haven't had a drink of alcohol. I really believed I needed one a long time before I took it, but I hadn't had a drink of alcohol. And I go into this luncheon, and there's this long table, and there's this big fountain. It's got this liquid coming out of it, and they've got these little glasses all lined up. And these ladies are picking up this glass, and they're sticking it under that fountain. And that day, I picked up one of those glasses, and I stuck it under that fountain. And, you know, I think it is amazing that alcoholics can remember their first drink. I remember the way it felt. I remember how warm it was. I remember the way it felt. And it was a really wussy drink. It was sherry. And I took that drink, and it was so warm. And Clancy talks about this spring that just, you know, that just gets tighter and tighter. And I just took that drink, and it just seemed like everything just sort of warmed up. And it seemed like for the first time, I could just breathe. I could just take a breath. And I stuck that glass under again, and I took another drink. Now, that's all I had that day, and I remember that. I remember it. I can't even remember what I did yesterday, but I remember that. And I had no idea that day what had happened to me, because, you see, I felt that feeling of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a drink of alcohol. At once. I didn't have to wait for that pill to digest or anything. Man, it came at once. And I got that feeling of ease and comfort. My son, who's an AA, said, the first time that happened, he loves the line in Bill's story, I had arrived. Because for the first time, that anxious feeling that I always had, I had a solution. Now, I didn't start drinking all the time right away. I mean, it seemed like I kind of eased into it. And that was in 1959. And in 1962, we got sent to an Air Force, up to the very tippy top of Maine, Loring Air Force Base, Maine. And I had two little boys. And I had no idea anything about parenting 101. And I had these two little boys. And we were up there sitting under a chill factor 5. I should have known something was up when they started giving us these parkas that had fur all around and you could just barely see out of them. And they issued them to us. And I thought, I should have known something was up. And I had these two little boys. And my husband was a SAC pilot, which meant that he was going to be gone, and he was going to be gone for years at a time. And I was going to be responsible for these two little boys. And I'm here to tell you that I took two little boys and drugged them through the disease of alcoholism. I drugged them through that disease. And I want you to know that, make no mistake, I loved my little boys. I love them. But if I took a drink of alcohol, I no longer could guarantee my behavior. And while I was at Loring Air Force Base, I told you I was very anxious and nervous and always uptight. And I went to an Air Force doctor, and he said, take these. And from 1962 until 1977, when I entered the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I took Librium and Valium and Seconal and Nemutol and drank alcohol. And I'm here to tell you, if you do that, you're not an active alcoholic. I did my dying on my living room sofa. I'm not a party girl. I didn't go partying, and I guarantee you it was not acceptable for an officer's wife to be drunk and disorderly when in public. And I don't know if any of you have had to sit at a dinner party or anywhere and just try the best way you knew how to just sip a drink. I mean, today, even thinking about it, the hair on the back of my neck just stands up. It was such a horrible feeling. And you just can't wait till I can get home, till I can just turn that bottle up, to just silence the madness that was going on inside of me. And having no clue what's wrong with me. Having no clue. I must be crazy. I have to be crazy. I had no clue what was wrong with me. Oh. When I got sober, I kind of do a little ADD right here because I'm going to tell you a little story before I get sober. I think God is so amazing that he gives us exactly what we need. I ended up going to treatment. I went 3 times. I'll even go into that a little bit more. I went 3 times. I didn't know that it was the wrong way to get sober. I didn't know that either. You know, Kent was talking about that. I didn't know that, he got a $25,000 book. I don't think it cost that much back then. But at any rate, I didn't know that you're just supposed to come to AA. I had no clue. And I went to treatment. And when I got out of treatment, I had met in one of my treatment centers this man who was in charge of the first detox center I went to. And it's a sweet little lady like me went to a detox. And a county detox. And I went to this detox, and I had met Frank. And Frank had been a Monsignor priest in the Navy. Now, I don't know how it is today. I don't think it's the same, because I think my perception of that Baptist church was a little skewed. But when I was going to that Baptist church, I know for sure I was in that Baptist church when I was 18 years old, because I got married in it. And John Kennedy was running for president. And I'm telling you, that preacher was having a hissy fit over John Kennedy because the Pope was going to run the United States because John Kennedy was a Catholic. So God's got a big sense of humor. Frank's a Monsignor Catholic priest who had left the priesthood to marry an Asian woman. He's also a captain in the Navy, and he's an only child. And I didn't know the rules in Alcoholics Anonymous, so when I got sober, I asked Frank to be my sponsor. I didn't know these rules, men ask men and women ask women. But he was a man who had saved my life, and I loved him. And when I finished my fifth step, I go into this treatment center, and he said, we're not going to take that Hazleton fifth step. We're going to do it like it's in the book. And I'm grateful. I got sober in Texas, and one of the things that happened in Texas when I got sober, they believed in doing the steps quickly. They're all kind of descendants of Dr. Bob, and it's just like Earl Treat when Dr. Bob took Earl Treat through the steps in an afternoon in his office. That's the way they did it. They believed in doing the steps quickly. And he said, we're going to do a four-step out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That Hazleton one doesn't count. And when I got through with my fifth step, he looked at me, and he looked at me with so much love, but he looked at me and he said, Polly, you are a child abuser. He didn't look at me and say, Polly, you have hurt your children. He looked at me and said, you are a child abuser. And I've never heard such words. And I'm here to tell you that I loved my sons, but I could not care for them, and they were left in my help, in my care. I am a woman who never should have been able to keep her children. I had a son who was an athlete, and I had a son who was a musician. And what happened was, is that I would promise that I'll be there. I'll promise I'll be at your game. I'll promise I'll be at your concert. I'll promise I'll be there. But you see, I take a drink of alcohol, and I don't make it. And then I come to, and I have these little faces down at the end of the sofa. And they're looking at me and said, Mom, you promised. And I start screaming, can't you see I'm sick? You don't think of anybody but yourself. If I wasn't sick, I'd have been there. And I make what's wrong with me their fault. I am a child abuser in every way. I have abused my children physically, emotionally, spiritually, and most of all, by blatant neglect is what I did to my sons. I don't have any great funny stories to tell you. None of those. I don't have any of those. I did my dying on my living room sofa, not taking care of my children. That's my story. My sons are 55 and 53 now, and I will guarantee you the signs are still there. Because you see, that never leaves. That scar is so deep, it never leaves. It never leaves. And I am always reminded, but let me tell you, we were talking today, this morning, about forgiveness. I have been so forgiven. I have been so forgiven. My sons have forgiven me. I have the mercy. God is merciful. Thank God he's not a punishing God. I thought he was a punishing God. But I have been delivered mercy. Such mercy that my sons love me, adore me, revere my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, revere it. They're so grateful to you because of who I am today. I just want to tell you a couple of stories because one of the things that I believe with all my heart is that the disease of alcoholism is a family disease. It tells me in the big book. It also tells me that the head of the household caused most of the trouble and that we will not even the score in this lifetime. So it's not my job for them to call me. You know, it's just like it's not my job for a newcomer to call me. It's my job to call them. Thank God Bill went to Bob, or none of us would be sitting here. Kent does a wonderful homecoming in Akron, Ohio, where we honor Dr. Bob. But if Bill hadn't gone to Akron and tried to find another alcoholic, you and I wouldn't be sitting here. But we always, I don't know where we get this, you know, where this came from, because we sure didn't start out this way, that people who come that are new in sobriety, they go interview sponsors. You know, you were just assigned a sponsor. And that's the way it was. And then what happens is that newcomer has to call you, please. One of the things that happens with the women I sponsor, in the meetings we go to, somebody's, you know, we always ask for newcomers. And especially in California, you had to stand for 30 days that if you were a newcomer. And I'm telling you, we were on them like white on rice. And do you have a sponsor? If they said no, we said, I'm your sponsor. And this is, I get out the book and start giving them meetings. They're newcomers. They don't know the difference. We think they're supposed to come ask us. That's not the way it used to be. That's not the way we operate either. They want somebody, as Bill says, an emotional sobriety. If they want somebody after a while that, you know, that works better for them, fine. But in the meantime, they've been going to meetings. So, a little preaching, sorry. Anyway, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. My youngest son, is 31 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we kind of grew up here together. And this morning, he was about 11 years old. And it's about 3 years before I got sober. because he got he was 14 when I got sober. He was about 10 or 11 years old. Now, I can no longer put my sons to bed at night, and I can no longer get them up in the morning. They have to set an alarm and get themselves up for school because I am incapable of doing that. And by this time, their dad is 100% disabled from the military. He came back from Vietnam and immediately fell at the age of 36 with congestive heart failure. So we're pretty sure that he got a big dose of Agent Orange. We don't know because there's no way to prove it. But what happened is he is completely and totally disabled. My son gets up this morning and he goes into the kitchen, and this is his reality because the disease of alcoholism alters our reality, and the people who live in that disease have an altered reality. And what happens is he goes in that morning and I'm passed out on the floor with a drink spilled. He steps over me, gets his cereal, gets the bowl, gets the milk, mixes it all up together, puts it all back. God forbid he leave anything out on the counter because I would go ballistic, and steps back over me and eats his breakfast. That is an abnormal reaction to that scene. But that was his reaction because that was his reality. That was his reality. My oldest son is the one who would put me to bed at night, who would take care of me. And many is the time I've come to, because if you take pills like I took and drink alcohol, you don't breathe too good. Very shallow breathing. And many's the time that I've come to with Russ screaming, "Mom, wake up, are you dead?" And me to come to and see the fear in his eyes. You know, for 39 years, I haven't had to look at that kind of fear in anybody's eyes because of something I'm doing. For that, if I get nothing else, I'm overpaid in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up after a series of car wrecks. I had the first car wreck, and I ended up calling the police and telling them that my car had been stolen. Here comes the police with my husband, a blackout drinker, and I get taken to the Irving police station. Got watching golf today on television. They were playing in Irving, Texas, and went to the jail in Irving, Texas. And this policeman looked at my husband with so much disgust, and he says, "Why don't you just take her home and sober her up?" And that night, I entered a detox center. That's where I met Frank. I entered this. I had two amazing Franks in my life. This was the first Frank. I met Frank, and he was the director of that program. And I'm here to tell you, I was unbelievably amazed. I guess it's before Alcoholics Anonymous, it was detox. But, you know, you sit around all night telling war stories. Oh, my God. Naive, they started talking, and these people in there in that detox center, they started talking. Some of them were divorced. Some of them had gone to jail. Worst of all, some of them had gone to prison. I was floored. I couldn't get enough of their stories. I didn't even say the F word then. I am so good at it now. I mean, I couldn't even believe this was so amazing. And what happened for me, that was a 7-day detox. And after 7 days, I had a jitterhouse romance. You know, where sick falls in love with sick and you run off into happy destiny, and we stayed sober for 58 days. I was 12-stepped out of a motel in Euless, Texas, by Frank. He came and got me, and I was beaten up and numerous and sundry other things. And he brought me back to that detox center, and I was more dead than alive. And I was so humiliated. I'd reached that place that talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Because I knew what the problem was then. And I love Clancy Sand talks about, let me tell you what happens to me when I'm sober. I knew what the problem was. The problem was sobriety. I can't live sober. I can't live with what I'm my parents' only child. My daddy, right then, the facts of my life, the facts of my life then, was my husband was 100% disabled from the Air Force. My father was dying of colon cancer in Henderson Hospital in Abilene. And my children were devastated, and their mother is running around like a nutcase. And they bring me back into that treatment center, and I can't stand it. I can't live sober. I can't live with myself. And we get that idea that the world is better without us. I can't live with that. And what happens is I set that 7 days out, and I leave that treatment center, and I get a bottle of Valium. I get a bottle of Valium and a bottle of scotch, and I check into a motel. I know today that I stand at this podium, and I walk every day in God's grace, as most of us do. There are thousands upon thousands of people who have my story. But what I did is I could not live sober. I didn't want to live anymore. What happens is by God's grace, and this has happened so many times, it's another celebrate a miracle. By God's grace, a woman I worked with knows nothing about alcoholism, but she said that day something came over her. And I know that something was God working in my life through her. And she drove around until she found my car parked outside this motel. And I hadn't shut the door all the way. It was just kind of closed. And she pushed it open, and she found me laying there. And on April the 8th of 1977, I was pronounced dead on arrival in a hospital in Bedford, Texas. I carried the ambulance report for a long time till it just shredded. I wish I'd have done something better with it. Most of us are here that we should have been dead, but we're not, because of God's grace. And this doctor looked at me and he said, "I don't know how you're alive. I did nothing for you." That story is told over and over and over in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we get to celebrate the miracle of God's love for us. Was that the last drink? No. Was it the last drink? When you try to commit suicide in the state of Texas in 1977, it's not one iota different than it is in 2016. You're going to get the attention of the authorities. And I was put on a 72-hour hold, and I was sent to a psychiatric hospital. And in that length of time, my husband was able to obtain a court order from a Fort Worth judge that I was a detriment to myself and others, and I was court-committed to treatment. And I entered that treatment center on April the 11th of 1977. And it is only by God's grace. And I don't care how many times we want to deny God. And I know that there are so many names we can call him. I believe, I don't know who said that, if it was said, I know my husband says it all the time. I don't think God cares what you call him. I don't think he cares. I lived in Washington State, and there is a lot of reservations, Native American reservations in Washington State. And I went to many, many meetings where they called God Great Spirit. There's many things that Bill calls it in the big book. Spirit of the universe, our great creator, many, many. I think there's probably 20 different versions of what he calls God in the big book. It doesn't matter. Whatever. All I have to know is that there is a God. And what I call him, I know one day there's a gal that I've sponsored a long time ago. She's not alive today. She died, but she died sober. And she said she always called God Howard. And I said, why do you call him Howard? And she heard one time that somebody called their God Howard because it, she thought it says, you know, that Howard, hallowed be thy name. He thought that said, Howard be thy name. And she always called. She said, I heard him speak and he called God Howard and it fit for me. So it doesn't matter. Just as long as I kneel to the God of my Creator, the Creator, I forever recognize that, and it means more to me today than it has ever meant that I have that connection. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and a vision for you. I didn't even look at what time I started. How am I doing on time? Pardon me?
Fine,
I know, but the taper usually has a different idea of that. Like, don't talk too long. 55? I'm on 55 now?
You get 55
now. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to tell you really quickly some great events that have come to pass. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that great events will come to pass. That's the fact. That's the great fact for us all. And I've had some great events. I told you the facts of my life when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not a star member. I ended up having a lot of affairs in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's, what can I say? By God's grace, I didn't drink. But I was not a poster child for AA. I had a best friend. His name was Dave Pistol. I've known him since I was 6 months sober, and we became friends. And we told each other all these things, and we often say if we'd have known we were going to get married, we wouldn't have told, you know, each other the things we told each other. He sponsored several of the guys I had had these encounters with, so he knew more about me than he needed to. And one day he looked at me and he said, Polly, I'm in love with you. And he says, you have to get something straight. I don't want to have an affair with you. I want to marry you. You know, things like that aren't supposed to happen to people like me. This past October, Dave and I celebrated 35 years of marriage. That's a long time to be hooked up. Marlene and Bill are going to celebrate 50. Two alcoholics hooked up. Woo-hoo! But I'm telling you, that's a great event at two alcoholics hooked up. We met on AA campus, and we've been married. And I'm here to tell you I'm more in love with him today than I've ever been. It's been an amazing journey. And, you know, life's been in session. That's the good news. I could never suit up and show up for my life. I couldn't suit up and show up for my life. But I have suited up and showed up for my life for 39 years, and that's a miracle. And, you know, life's in session. Life goes on. Just because we're sober doesn't mean life doesn't happen. Life happens. In 1993, I mean, Dave and I were riding the AA train. We were 17 and 16 years sober, and oh my God, was life fabulous. Dave is a computer scientist working for a big aerospace company in Southern California. We owned a home. I mean, you know, it was all there. And lo and behold, his company downsized. Dave was 57 years old. There wasn't anybody looking for a 57-year-old computer scientist. And we ended up having our home foreclosed on. We ended up having to file bankruptcy. Oh my God. I thought, it can't get any worse than this. This is as bad as it can get. And we're in AA. What are people going to think? What step do they think we're working if all this stuff is happening? And I had Frank Honeycutt, the man in Long Beach, finest man I've ever known. And he was my husband's sponsor and he was my son's sponsor. And I had a lady named Dottie Harris. And Dottie was my sponsor for 35 years. And Frank, when I left Texas, I had heard Dottie speak in Austin. I said, if I ever find that woman, I'll ask her to be my sponsor. And she was my sponsor for 35 years. And I didn't want to speak anymore because I've always been told to live your life out loud. You tell it like it is from the podium. You know, you got to tell the, you know, you can't just, you got to tell what happened. You got to tell that, you got to tell your story. And I didn't want to do that. And I looked at Frank and I said, what will people think? And he says, it's none of your business what people think. But your life, your very life depends on what you think of them. It doesn't matter what they think of you. And Dottie said, there is somebody who needs to hear your story. It had happened to some of the women I worked with and other women, but it never had happened like it happened in 2006 when so many people lost everything. By then, Dave and I were on Medicare, so we didn't care. But what happened to them had happened along the way, but I had a story to share that there is life after foreclosure. And there is life after bankruptcy, and you will live through it. Your ego will suffer immensely, but you will live through it. 12 years ago, Dave's oldest son died. He was 42 years old. It's a tragedy. It's a tragic thing to lose a child. In 1993, 23 years ago, my first grandchild was born. And I'm telling you, I couldn't, you've never seen such happy people. And this kid comes out and he's a total cherub. He's beautiful, blonde, curly hair. He looks like God dropped an angel out of heaven. He's so gorgeous. And we started to notice there was something wrong with Ryan. He just didn't seem to be like other kids. And when Ryan was 18 months old, it took that long, they finally realized that he was profoundly deaf. And I just had my fist at God. I was so angry at God. I worked in detoxes. I worked in halfway houses. And there were women who had children, me included, who had had children and abused that privilege. And some of these women didn't even want their children. And we wanted our baby. And our baby was deaf. And I knew that his life was ruined. I want to tell you how ruined Ryan is. He's a senior at Rochester Institute of Technology. He's studying to be a civil engineer. He has traveled the world and he's deaf. He just took a trip to Indonesia, and he spent a week with his dad and the next 2 weeks alone in Indonesia. He is handicapped in no way. I used to, you know, when used to people, you could fly, and then Ryan was a little, he was a little boy, and before 2000 and that 9/11, 2001, you didn't have all this airport security. And these people would walk around LAX airport, and they were selling pencils and things, and they would come around and they'd give you a little card, and they would say, I'm deaf, please help me. I'd look at them, I'd say, get a job. Because I knew that there was nothing wrong by then with my son, my grandson. And you know how we feel like that we're different? Ryan went to Evanston High School. It's a high school of 4,000 students. And he went to high school with an interpreter, and he was the only deaf kid there. Every day, he didn't feel different. He was different. But wah, you know, the alcoholic cries on. Amazing. An amazing man. I have 5 grandchildren that have never seen me drink. And I'm telling you, I'm a roller coaster riding grandma. And I love it. and I'm fun. And God's blessed me with good health and a lot of energy. And it's a blessing. Okay, I'm going to tell you. My son got sober when I was 6.5 years sober. I'm going to tell you really quick. Ryan called me up. Ryan, that's my grandson. James called me up, and he said, Mom, I want what you have. And 6.5 years before, he did not want what I had. 6.5 years before, I was supposed to attend a function at his school. And he said, don't you dare show up at my school because I am ashamed of you. 6.5 years later, he called me up and he said, Mom, I want what you have. My son is 31 years active member in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My oldest son had tried to take his life many, many, many times. He'd cut on himself, all of the stuff that we've heard about. Russ has not hurt himself in many, many, many years today. God has been so good. And I have been delivered a gift of mercy. I made amends to my sons. And when I did, they were 14 and 16 years old. And they had, when I made amends and I asked, do they have anything to say to me? I thought somebody had shot me with an Uzi. They had a lot to say that day. They had a lot to say that day. But that's not the case today. My life is amazing. I sponsor women. God, I am so crazy about women. I love it. We do a conference down in Atlanta, if you want to come in, first weekend in June, called Girl Stock. And it's nothing but the most amazing women in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. We have 8 women speakers. It's amazing. This past year, my husband went in to get a little back surgery, just a little road. He's got a really bad back. They were going to do a little laser surgery on him, very non-invasive surgery, to release some nerves because he has stenosis so bad. And just as routine, they took a chest x-ray. And one of the stories, Bob Darrell tells that story about the farmer who had the horse who ran off, and all the people in the village said, oh, how terrible. And the farmer goes, maybe, maybe not. The next thing you know, here comes his son with all these horses. And the people in the village say, oh, my gosh, you're the luckiest man in the village. You're the richest man in the village. You are so lucky. Maybe, maybe not. And then what happens? His son is trying to break a horse and breaks his back. Then here comes the emperor, and he's going to gather up all the young people. But his son doesn't go because he has a broken back. Is it bad? Maybe, maybe not. In 2006, my husband went in for a back x-ray, and his chiropractor said, I shouldn't be able to see your ascending aorta. 5 days later, he had a quadruple bypass. Never had a heart attack, never had a sign. That back. Is it bad? Maybe, maybe not. He went in for this laser surgery. He's very crippled with his back. And it's very hard he's a rock climber, a kayaker, a backpacker, all the stuff he did. And he goes in for this surgery. Very non-invasive. They do a chest x-ray because he's got to have a mild anesthetic. And they tell him he's got a spot on his lung. And he goes and gets a CAT scan. And not only does he have a spot on his lung, he has a cloud on his heart. And what ends up happening is he had a blood clot in his heart. He's got to go on blood thinners. And then he gets a pain in his stomach. And we run into the emergency room. The cancer is double inside. He has very aggressive small cell something, squamish cancer or something. I forget the name of it. And he gets, have his lung removed and ends up with chemo. And we were in his oncologist's office on Wednesday. And she looked at him, and she said, you are cured from lung cancer. Is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? Blessing after blessing, miracle after miracle. And let me tell you this man's faith. He went into that surgery 80 years old. And they did an absolute, in fact, the doctor said, you have a benchmark because you've had open heart surgery. This will be at least 50 times worse than your open heart surgery. 80. He never made a whimper about it. Never. In fact, he's always said, that never has even started to hurt as bad as my back. Blessing after blessing, and never once doubted that he would be fine. Never once did he have a single doubt. I was terrified. I realized, I thought I had, I just surrender it all, I thought. But when I was faced with that, and I saw it happening, and I took care of him, and I have been taking care of him since that happened on December 3rd. It's a very long process. It's a tough thing, huh, Marlene? It's a tough thing. Marlene's had lung cancer, too. Blessing after blessing. Is there a God? You bet. You bet. And he's huge and in charge. Do I love AA and the God I found in AA? You bet. And any time I want to forget it, I can listen to my son, because he said, I knew that AA worked because I got to see the transformation in my mother. God bless you.